Act, session number 30285.
John Dixon, reel 9.
Yes. Well, we started off 1944, on the 1st of January, in fact, with about 16 and a half hour sortie where we went out into the Atlantic and met a convoy and stayed with it as long as was practicable. And again on the 13th of January, we were off again on an anti-submarine patrol in the southwest Atlantic. The weather was fine, and things would be very quiet as we went out there. And then a U-boat was sighted on the surface. No other activity around it at all. It seemed to be quite happy steaming along. And we went in and attacked it with the first stick of depth charges, which didn't seem to halt it, and neither did it submerge, but still carried on passing it forward. So we came around, of course, and for another attack, but this time it was rather strange. There were great blobs of large blobs of black smoke appearing alongside our aircraft. The height was excellent. Looking out through the beam gun portholes, there were these clusters of black, what were quite clearly explosives around us. But as we went in for the attack, and so we dropped another four depth charges on it. But it was still on the surface, and there was no apparent sign of any damage. On this particular attack, I'd been standing on manning both the beam guns, so I didn't actually see the frontal attack that we made on it. Although my skipper said later on that the U-boat commander was a flyby and knew how tight to turn to throw out our direction of attack and things like that. But strangely enough, the anti-aircraft fire, which had opened up on us quite a long distance away, was clearly not what we had been taught to expect on a U-boat, which was normally fitted with 420 millimeters on the bandstand to the rear, plus its light ACAC. But here was some other weapon being used, which was producing great black smoke, bombs, shells that were going off, which was very interesting. But coming back to the actual U-boat, it started to dive or sink, and the angle of descent was so acute that from the beam side I could see the paint on the underside of the U-boat, and I was busy giving it some point finds to shells to help it on its way down. And the angle of descent was so acute that we took immediately the view that in fact it was sinking and out of control, and lo and behold, there it is. It, as the angle increased, so down it went and disappeared. So when it came to the debriefing on that particular attack, we were quite adamant that yes, all right, we sunk that one. Although there were no signs of oil or survivors or any debris to indicate that the attack had been solid. So there was an element of doubt. And as you know, the people who do the debriefing and understanding of these matters up at Coastal Command at the time are very rigid. Before they announced that the thing had been sank, they examined all the evidence. However, we assumed that it was U-boat 377. Later on, when we found out that the U-boat had been sunk in that area, but in fact, it turned out to be U-621. We'd wounded a number of the crew who were manning the guns on on our attacks, and they killed some of the crew, and we caused very severe damage to the U-boat, in fact, and it was so bad that it was touchy whether they'd get back to France. So, but ultimately, of course, they did manage to get back, and it was sunk later on in the year, in fact, by a Canadian destroyer rounded off. So that was the result of that attack. We weren't hit in anywhere, and we didn't show no signs of any damage to the aircraft. Now it's interesting what happened there. with that. We were called as a crew to Coastal Command headquarters because they were interested in the type of weapons that were being used by the U-boats. When we went to Coastal Command, we discovered that some of the U-boats had had their 20 millimeters taken off and they're now fitted up, well, I think it was 3.7 or some heavy gun, and it was that thing that had been banging off. And so I wouldn't like to have been hit by it. But then going back to the post-war period, when I went to Germany to see the survivors of that particular U-boat, the engineering officer who was still there took me around to see a static U-boat that had been mounted up there at the U-boat bases in the Baltic. And I said, what happened to it? Why didn't you shoot us down with that big gun? He said, because they are the bloody shells were no good. They've been in the water and they were damp or something, and all their activity came to a halt when the ammunition wouldn't fire. So that was the end of that. So it took a long time for us really to fully appreciate that it hadn't been sunk. But they were quite pleased at Coastal Command at what we'd done, of course. So it was back to Ballykelly again, to the base, and ready for the next one. Very shortly after that, very interesting actually, in only a matter of days, 4 days later, we were down in that area, further south, doing a rather strange trip. We were escorting the King George V, as you know, it was the battleship, and she had some cruisers, the Belfast was with her, and some other destroyers giving close escort. And what in fact was happening, Winston Churchill was aboard the King George V. He'd been down there, as you know, to Casablanca with Roosevelt, and he was on his return back to UK, because we weren't aware exactly what was going on. But it was a nice trip, and we were with them for, 16 hours and 10 minutes. We brought them back that far anyway. So that was that. And so things, I suppose, in a way, then went back into their normal routine of convoy escorts, anti-submarine patrols, and a mixture of those sort of things.
Were you aware of the sort of changing nature of the U-boat war? Because 1943 had been quite crucial, hadn't it?
Yes, it had. It had been on decisive, really. We were aware that we weren't getting the sightings and the kills that we'd been achieving in the past, and clearly something was going wrong there, because people were doing the standard patrols that we'd always been doing, and in effect, I suppose, increasing them in a way as the aircraft became available. And we must remember that the Liberator squadrons were increasing in number throughout the year, so in fact we had a larger force to deal with the problem. But we began to see that it was getting difficult to find them. We didn't quite know what the name of the game was. As you know, he reallocated areas of operations to his U-boats to cut the losses down, and that had shown up after the Holocaust of May of 43. Yes. So we carried on doing much the same thing, but of course it was, after all, 1944, and we were unaware of what was imminent, and so we just carried on doing our own type of things, unaware that there would be a marked change in the type of employment that we put on.
So in that early part of the year, were you still operating in the same sorts of areas?
Yes. We hadn't, up until then, we hadn't moved to any new operational areas. We did, as you'll see a bit very shortly, we did start to look at places that we'd never looked before. But until then, clearly that was associated with the fact that the second front came into action, and all things changed from there on. The only other thing of interest was that in April of 1944, we escorted the Queen Elizabeth down to the Southwest Atlantic, and brought her back into the Northwest Atlantic, and the Queen Mary. So we were still giving cover to those ships, which, if I may say, the Navy didn't seem to be aware of. And that's interesting. We should bring up the question of were we still operating in the same area, because we did in fact in May move for the first time to a totally unexpected area of operations. As far as we were concerned, we were sent to Norway, where we began to patrol off the Norwegian coast. One of the first trip I see I did with it, we were actually patrolling an area 60 miles off the Norwegian coast, because of course what was happening, a lot of the U-boats were being moved from France and were being sent up to the German U-boat bases in Norway.
So this was even prior to D-Day occurring. Was that move occurring earlier
yes.
on than that?
Yes, it appears that we were actually up in Norway before the second front started, which was June, of course, wasn't it, on the 6th? And I'm talking here about May. So a month before the second front, we had changed our area of operations and were now operating well up in the north of Norway.
What about the duration of such patrols? Were they shorter, or would you spend longer on patrol?
No, they were much the same. They were 16, 17 hours, varied, give or take, but that was about the duration. We flew up to Scotland, and we used Tain as a refueling base there. So we'd land in Tain, refuel, and then head up north-east to the Norwegian ports.
Was there any difference operating in that area than say, in the Atlantic?
Well, it's strange enough, yes. In May of month, we'd been up to Norway, and the first trip we did was on the 16th of May. And then we were back up there again on the 24th, and that was an interesting one, because we'd been briefed that a U-boat was in trouble up there, heading for Norway, and whether the damage had been caused by previous attacks or something, but it seemed to have been on the surface. So we were briefed to go out there and find it and do the necessary. We got to the area which we were told U-boat was in, and far from meeting a U-boat, what we met was a destroyer, a German destroyer with two U-boats, and it didn't take too much thinking to realize that they were probably coming out there to escort that U-boat back in. So we hunted round and round and round, but we never did sight the U-boat. But we gave a, and I did actually, because I was on the starboard beam guns at them, so I gave a few shots down to the enemy destroyer, and just to let them know that Coastal Command was still about. That little story was ended really, I think it was the following day, when Squadron 8 Assistance, who was one of our flight commanders, was also sent to finish off the job that we hadn't been able to achieve. And they did find it. They did find the destroyer, they did find the U-boat, and that attack was made under the support of the guns from the destroyer, of course. But old Sissons, he sank it. And the flight engineer, who I think had been manning up the nose gun and had been pressing that they should attack, was awarded the DFM, which I think was the only time an NCO got an award in my period, other than the pilot.
It sounds like it was a very detailed intelligence, though, you were receiving at that stage. Almost that you were being specifically placed to do a mission, and that was a single U-boat. So rather than hunting, you were being given an area, weren't you, that this boat will be here.
That's right, and it was, in effect, it was there, because it was submerged, but it was there where we were told to look for it. It was pretty much where the same place where our assistants went out and found it. And he found the same boats as we found. So it couldn't have been a very large variation. But of course, as you know, the quality of the intelligence being received was very high. I mean, by the nature of the U-boat war, the U-boat commanders were constantly sending signals backwards and forwards, and under the control by signal of the U-boat commanders. So yes, they maintained quite a high level of observation on what was taking place, and they tended to know a great deal about the position of these things. They probably intercepted the earlier message sent by the U-boat commander that he'd been damaged or whatever and was returning back to base. And it was very accurate intelligence, as you rightly say.
And how would you, when you did the patrols to the Norwegian coast, you said you were 60 miles off the coast, but what type of patrol would it be? Would it be a square search again? Would it be across the lane?
We were just flying a box patrol up the coast and back, so 60 miles on the port. Outside, then turn at the top and come back down and do another patrol. So that's the type of thing we were doing. We were given particular areas to look off. In fact, it was the first time I'd ever seen a German aircraft in the air on one of those patrols, because the weather was very nice up there. Visibility was excellent. And I, as I said, I was under, and I suddenly saw an aircraft fly about the stern of us at right angles. It looked to me like an ME-110, and indeed, it was probably an ME-110 because the Germans had ME-110 fighters up there, giving cover to the area. So, but that's the only time I'd seen a German aircraft on any of our sorties, even though we weren't far away. And that was it. So that particular incident with the destroyer and so on was on the 24th of May, but I say we were back up there again on the 28th. We were being heavily flown by this time, and we're back up again off Norway doing these patrols again, them picking up. And that was that was 28th, and again we were using Tain as our base for refueling.
How would you do that? Would you, when refueling at a base like that, would you literally just refuel, or would you stay there at all?
No, just refuel. Yeah, just refuel and then straight off. And that was built into the briefing. It never got out of the aircraft.
Given the duration of the Liberator, how long would it take to refuel it normally?
Oh no, that's an interesting question. You know, I can't remember. I really can't remember. The reason for that was probably because, of course, the aircraft were already fully refueled at home when we went to go and collect them. Everything was in order, wasn't it? And the petrol and the fuel tank was already there. But with refueling it, mind you, we had refueled at other places like St. Elmo on trips like that. I can't remember it was anything spectacular. I must take it was a fairly routine procedure. As you know, that some of these places had underground refueling, so refueling varied quite a bit. Whether they came up with their buses and new fuel, or whether they came from underground thing, which would obviously have an effect on it. But to be truthful, I can't actually remember. Okay. I hadn't thought of that.
Where were the fuel tanks located in the Liberator?
In the wings and the Bombay. The Bombay ones that I mentioned to you before, there were two additional Bombay tanks put in the forward Bombay areas. They were these overload tanks that gave us the additional range to do these sorties, as opposed to the other mark the Liberators, which didn't do that, but carried more bombs, but flew less, obviously. So that was happening. You have to remember that at that time, there were probably only three squadrons that were very long range. There were a number of Liberator squadrons based down in the south coast, but they didn't have the range that we had. And they carried more bombs, which was very good. So that then took us through the way. And then I remember we were briefed, we had to go to the operations room. And it was fairly obvious that there was something going on that was of acute interest to everybody. And it was then we were briefed about that the Second Front had been put into action, and that we would be sent down to give support to them. And I remember there was a bit of nonsense going on. Who was going to be the first aircraft off Ballykilly to get down there and give support to the landings? And if I may say, we were the first off and headed down there. At the same time, we received Eisenhower's message to the troops, telling what we were doing and why we were doing it and all that sort of thing. So there was this great feeling about it, that decisive things were happening. And of course they were decisive enough for the U-boat commander, Dönitz, got rid of the last of his U-boats from France as fast as he could and sent them up the Atlantic and then back to the Norwegian bases, which of course is why we've been up there measured some days before. What we did, we flew down from Ballykelly down to the English Channel, and our first job was to do a box patrol south of Stark Point towards Cherbourg. And of course what we were doing with the other Liberators and in other areas, we were effectively sealing the right flank of the invasion force. And that apparently, as I read later, had been very well handled and deeply planned to ensure that there would be no interference with the Navy bringing the troops and things across the channel. And that in fact worked out in practice. That was on a similar patrol to what we did. A flight lieutenant from which airfield, but down in the south there, we sank two U-boats in 20 minutes, a Liberator, and he was awarded a DSO for that. I think in all those patrols that we were doing down there, about 12 U-boats were sunk. It was so decisive again that Dönitz then gave orders that the U-boats were to retreat from the channel, other than those which had by this time had been fitted with a snorkel. So the snorkel fitted U-boats were told to do what they could. The others were sent back to Norway.
They weren't, I believe, very successful in any attacks, though, on the invasion fleet at all, were they?
I've read that one ship was sunk or damaged by a U-boat, and I don't know of any other losses.
Was the Navy patrolling the same sort of area as well, or was it purely just your...
With just us.
Could there have been the potential threat of aircraft attack during these things? Because you would have been relatively close to land, wouldn't you, in comparison to what you
were? Yes, and under different circumstances, yes, we'd have been well within radar range, easily from the French coast, and they could have intercepted us. But of course, by that time, most of the German tactical air force had been smashed on the ground and in the air, and there was very little air opposition. So I'm not aware that any of the anti-U-boat aircraft were shot down by other aircraft. If there is, I don't know of it. And it was one. I see that on the 15th of June, a week or so after the Second Front landing, we were doing a similar thing down in the English Channel, and I remember the port beam gunner suddenly gave a bellow to through the intercom to say he's sighted a periscope, roughly on the heading. So we promptly did a quick turn to try and find it, but it had gone. So we didn't even get an attack in, but he was a very lucky, a very, very, very lucky dude, I can tell you. If he'd have stayed there like that for a few minutes longer, yeah.
When something happens like that, when something's been spotted and you have to turn around with the aircraft to come back to that, is it difficult then to re-establish the exact location that's happened on?
It's not easy. It's not easy because there's no pinpoints. So it's everybody in the aircraft. Everybody is looking hard in all directions on the turn to try and see what's happening. And and we wouldn't have had a radar return on it. So that was the problem. We wouldn't have had that. And we didn't have a radar return, because a periscope wouldn't give a sufficient signal to, and particularly in the sea return, which was on the radar, and the thing was down below us, more or less, we wouldn't get a signal. So that was it. So he was a very, very lucky U-boat. A couple more minutes and we would have been a problem. So that was the contribution that the squadron and the other liberators that were making down there in the channel.
How long did that go on for, that period when you were doing that in the channel?
Not very long. I think once we'd established a foothold on the thing, that was it. What the tension changed almost with the invasion shortly, where we're back again in Norway, where again the surviving U-boats from France were trying to get back.
At that stage then, had the U-boats been withdrawn from all of the Atlantic coast ports?
Yes.
Even though, because I know that some of them were held by the Germans until the end of the war, but there was no longer that threat, was there, from those? The U-boats had actually left from all those bases?
That's right. Yes, they'd gone. All the surviving ones had left. So that threat down there to the flanks and so on didn't exist anymore. Never did after that. And they were all heading as fast as they could to Norway to get in there.
And I take it you were aware of that because of the changing nature of your operations.
We knew what was taking place. Oh yes, yeah. And so we weren't kept down there very long, because there was really no reason for it. Once the invasion, of course, had been firmly established, and the U-boats had been withdrawn from the area, there was no point in going there anymore. We had to follow where they were going, which is exactly what we did. But there were still, having said that, there were still U-boats, of course, wandering around the Atlantic on patrol. And, you know, it wasn't a complete withdrawal from over. So there were those jobs still had to be done. And I see here that on the 22nd of June, we were sent to meet the Empress of Scotland, and when we got there, there'd been a U-boat attack, but again, we didn't see anything, so we came back after another 16 hours sortie. And so we carried on throughout June there, doing creeping line aheads in the North Atlantic, clearing the way for the convoys and so on. And here, as I said to you just now, we're back up again in Norway, following the activity. But the weather was so bad that on that particular occasion that we were recalled, having been airborne for about 12 hours or so. And so there we are, back again, up in Norway, and back again in the North Atlantic, doing the jobs that we used to do.